Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Musical little theme welcomes you to another LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and downloadable onto your pod. Given the immensity of US military power, given the vastness of the military budget, I was astonished to learn that only 1% of the American population are part of the military. That's down from an all-time high of 12% during World War II, 4% during Vietnam. And we've also learnt in preparing for tonight's program that there is a deep divide between civilian America and military America, and a fair amount of mutual hostility. This was drawn to our attention by the undiplomatic diplomat Tex, our old mate Tex, Tex Harris, who sent us an article, wonderful article, by Christian Henderson. Christian's married to a Navy chaplain and a working journalist, and she's been with him on his postings to Afghanistan and Iraq, and her essay on the isolation and misunderstanding experienced by military families is very compelling. So what we're going to do shortly is I'm going to introduce you to, yes, Kristen, Richard H. Cohn, Sarah Sewell, and welcome back an old friend of the program, Neil James. I'll introduce them more fully and fulsomely in just a moment. But first of all, a couple of small matters. On our last program, I made mention that David Salter had dedicated his book, The Media We Deserve, to a few praiseworthy journalists who've gone to God, including Frank Bennett. And following that discussion with David, I spoke to Rupert Guinness, who's written a book about his father-in-law, Keith Bennett, the flying grocer. Keith was a World War II pilot who was involved in the humanitarian food drops over Holland in 1945 to head off mass starvation. Well, as it happens, thanks to a phone call from Keith's wife, Elva Bennett, we now know that Keith and Frank are brothers. Now, what an illustrious family. In the one program, without realising it, we made mention of two of the Bennett brothers who had distinguished themselves in their own right and in very different realms. The other thing, it relates to a comment I made a couple of weeks ago in a discussion about Norma Currie, another prominent, indeed, notorious literary frauds and hoaxes that Australia has experienced. And I made a passing ad lib reference to a chilling encounter with Helen Demidenko. And I point out that Demidenko was revealed a little later as a fictitious character, like Ern Malley. In that discussion, I said I'd interviewed Demidenko on Late Night Live. Well, I've been involved in so many interviews and so many radio studios over so many years that I got it wrong. I found on checking, the encounter was not on this program. And thinking back, I remembered meeting Demidenko in the green room of another ABC studio where we were both booked as interviewees. When did this happen? Well, she just won her big literary prize and I was flogging a book of my own. Hadn't read hers, and the scandal was yet to break. Why did I describe her as chilling? Well, I found her to be marmoreal, very cold. I understand that Helen, in her latest incarnation, insists we've never met. Well, that's hard to establish a decade on, but being neither chilling nor thrilling, I clearly made no impression on Helen at all. Now, during the wars of the 20th century, the level of public involvement and support of the national war effort was usually strong and unreserved and essential to the morale of the forces. Everyone was affected by it to some extent, and part of the reason for that was probably because a greater percentage of the population were members of the military. But the terrorist attacks of 9/11, or September 11, as we call it in this part of the world, and the subsequent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have brought about another wave of alienation between serving members of the military forces and those remaining at home. However, this also highlights another divide which has existed between members of America's civil and military establishments, mainly since Vietnam, but it certainly flared up again during the Kennedy administration and the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs. One study revealed that elite members of civil and military institutions remain suspicious of one another and, quote, continue to harbour strong negative stereotypes about the other beneath a surface expression of respect and confidence. A more recent survey found that less than half the civilian population believe military leaders can be relied upon to respect civilian control, and over 20% of Americans said they'd be disappointed if their children joined the military. Okay, wide-reaching implications here, one would think, for government policy, particularly on the way wars are waged. Tonight, let's explore the history of this divide and look at how a different approach to Iraq, which might have included greater civilian and humanitarian input, could have turned out. Now, I'm joined now by Dr. Richard H. Cohn. Richard is Professor of History and Peace, War and Defence at the University of North Carolina. He's the author and editor of many a book and is acknowledged as an expert in this area of contemporary civil-military relations. From Massachusetts, Sarah Sewell. Sarah is director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Sarah was the first person to hold the position of Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Peacekeeping and Humanitarian Assistance in the Clinton administration. And I was interested to learn that she assisted General David Petraeus in drafting his now legendary counterinsurgency field manual. And from the US base in Sasebo, Japan, the aforementioned Christian Henderson, journalist and the author of While They're at War, the true story of American families on the home front. As I said, she's married to a Navy chaplain who served with the Marines in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Kristen's been active in the Marine Corps' Key Volunteer Family Readiness Program and the Navy's Spouse Mentoring Program. And we have to acknowledge yet again that it was her article in the Washington Post that that inspired this discussion. Oh, Canberra studio, Neil James. Neil, of course, Executive Director of the Australia Defence Association and a former lieutenant. You see, Neil, I didn't say lieutenant tonight, in the Australian Army, including the Defence Intelligence Organisation. Christian, when did you first begin to observe this change in attitude from the general public towards members of the military?
Well, I don't think I was even aware of it until, even after my husband had joined the military, several years later, after 9/11, after September 11th, he began deploying with the Marines to war zones. And it was while he was in Iraq, I ran into a neighbor who said, you know, wow, what is that like having your husband in a war zone? And it hit me how few people know what that's like, because like you said, so few people serve anymore. And of course, when you send a soldier to war, you're sending a whole family. That effect ripples through the family and their friends. But, you know, there are just a limited number of families that this is affecting. And so it struck me that it was really important for civilians to understand all the consequences of war, not just what happens on the front lines, which we're all fairly familiar with through media reports and movies and books. But they needed to understand how that rippled back through the family and the community around them.
Well, as you point out, military families experience high levels of isolation, don't they? Because nobody else really understands what they go through, particularly during wartime deployments.
Exactly. I mean, they actually suffer from something called anticipatory grief. This is very common, where your body begins to react as if the person you love is already dead. So you go through all the symptoms of grieving, even though they're alive and well. And unless you've lived through it, you wouldn't know what that felt like. And in fact, those of us who do live through it often don't even know what it is we're feeling.
Kristen, is it a form of defense? Is it sort of going through in advance the tragedy that people fear? Is it a way of coping?
It could be. I think, though, it's simply a normal reaction to a really abnormal situation. You know, the fear that that person you love will not come back is with you every single moment of the day that you're awake, and often in your dreams as well. And what's so important is that it's civilians, these civilians who don't know what this is like, who make the decision about when and where we go to war. And yet they don't have all the information they need to make decisions about whether or not a war is worth fighting.
Now, Kristen, we'll be teasing that out a little later, but there's a big picture attitude thing here as well. According to research, nearly two-thirds of military leaders believe they share the same values as ordinary American civilians, but only one-third of civilians agree. They seem to believe that service members are intolerant, rigid, and lacking in creativity.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what it's like when you don't know anybody. I mean, many Americans don't know anybody actively serving in the military, and so they become the other. And you tend to kind of superimpose over them whatever stereotypes you've picked up from books and movies.
Mm. Richard, historically, military service in your country and indeed in ours was a proud civic duty. But when over 20% of Americans say they wouldn't want their kids to join the military, is this a sort of a hostility to the Bush administration, or is it more profound?
Well, I think it goes back a long way, actually. There have been negative stereotypes about the military in American history all the way back to the founding of the Republic. What's interesting about this, it's not a Bush administration phenomenon, I think. I think it is... the general lack of understanding and a backward echo of the past, because the modern military, of course, is much more professional, much more highly educated than it used to be. And I think simply that the American public has not caught up with the reality, even though we had a draft army from 1940 to the early 1970s.
Mm. Now, I mentioned earlier that only 1% of your population are a part of the military, compared to, well, a predictable 12% during World War II, 4% during Vietnam. But what you're saying now is that 1% is smarter, better educated, so the military is no longer, if you like, an alternative form of the dole, as we call it here, a career choice for the disadvantaged.
Well, in some respects it is, I think, in the enlisted ranks, because something like two-thirds of American high school graduates go on to college, and we're not recruiting our soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines from that college group except for the officer corps. So to a large degree, the enlisted force is coming from people who have less alternatives or are motivated by patriotism and the times.
Mm.
So there is a bit of ambiguity in all of this. But that's always been the case in peacetime America, except for the large mobilizations of war and then the first half of the Cold War. It's always been a volunteer force, and it's not been reflective of American society overall. In the 1980s and 1990s, because the military was smaller and the pay and emoluments and conditions were improved, the military could choose from only high school graduates and only people who could successfully complete their training.
Mm. Richard, I habitually look at the Lehrer Hour before I come into work. It's shown on one of our public broadcasting channels. And as you know, they end the program most nights with this in silence, showing the faces and identifying the names of generally young blokes who have been killed in Iraq or Afghanistan. And I must say that I cannot help but notice there's a very high percentage of Hispanics.
Well, I think there are more Hispanics serving than in the past, but my own understanding of the statistics of it is that it's not out of proportion.
Okay, so that's just an impression I get, and it wouldn't hold up to statistical scrutiny.
Yes, and I don't think that there are more Hispanics serving as a percentage of the military than they are in the population. That's the fastest growing minority population
sure.
in the United States, and is now larger, I think, in numbers than African Americans.
Neil James, you recently visited Australian troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do they feel strongly publicly supported?
In general, they do. But because they're over there, and to some extent they're isolated from the public debate here in Australia, they have a natural concern that people back home don't understand what they're doing. And something the association's concerned about is a growing divergence of opinion between the troops over there in terms of their faith in the mission and their worth and how well they think they're doing, and a growing divergence of opinion back here at home that doesn't see them as fulfilling something worthwhile, particularly in Iraq.
Yes. There have been a few reports, in fact many reports, that US soldiers are simply exhausted. What about Australian troops?
Nowhere to the same extent. The American Army's in operational strain. I think everyone accepts that. The Marine Corps is in a lot better shape. The Australian military aren't stretched, and they're not stretched for a number of reasons, but the key one, of course, is both in absolute numbers and as a percentage. We have a much smaller part of the force overseas. One of the reasons that they are a small force is because we haven't got the equipment to send a larger one, but the advantage of them being a relatively small force is they're not producing the same strains on the force structure back home and indeed on the wider family group that supports them.
Kristen, the Republican Senator Chuck Hagel says that the US military is being forced to ignore its own deployment standards and that maintaining the current deployment tempo is wearing down troops and their families. Can you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these families are tired, and their service members are as well. I mean, I think one of the common misconceptions is that the more you do this, the better you get at it in terms of, you know, going through deployments. And it's true that you do pick up some coping skills, but every deployment is different. You're in a different place. If you have children, they're different ages, and you're experiencing different things. And so if there are, you know, problems developing, and certainly we always change during a deployment, you have to reintegrate that back into your relationship when they come back home, whether it's between spouses and children or parents. And then if you don't have time to kind of finish that reintegration before the next deployment starts, the problems start to compound, and that's what we're starting to see. A lot of these families and service members are on their third and fourth deployment.
I want to bring belatedly, forgive me, Sarah Sewell into the discussion at the moment. In your vast experience, Sarah, do you see a noticeable gap in civilian knowledge and understanding of the military, and perhaps a growing gap?
It has been growing in historical terms. The gap to me, from my vantage point in looking at the question that Christian raises about decisions to use force, the gap is most notable among those who are in Congress now. That we have the smallest number of senators and representatives with military experience than we have had historically since World War II. We have an administration that has made many decisions about the use of force in which many of its own leaders have not served and have consciously chosen not to serve. I think the point about that gap is less one among society. I want to take a little bit issue with the premise about the polling. I think the American people, by and large, are extremely grateful to those who serve, but grateful in an almost selfish way. I don't have to worry about it. The military is taking care of it. I think that's a particular kind of gap, but I think there's a different gap which has to do with a lack of sensitivity to what Christian is pointing out are the human costs of war for those who serve, and that piece is not adequately taken into account by policymakers who lack a direct and visceral appreciation of it.
Christian, since 9/11, America has struggled to meet new recruitment goals, yet at the same time, I didn't know this, there's been a surge in re-enlistments. Why are Iraq vets volunteering to return in surprising numbers?
Well, you talk to, you know, five different people, you'll get five different answers. But some of that is, you know, for instance, what happened with my husband when he came back from Iraq. He wanted to go back, in part because he knew there were other people carrying the load there, who, you know, that he wanted to be part of that and help carry that burden. And also, I think when you're over there doing what you've been trained to do, you're testing yourself. And you may or may not feel like you rose to the challenge in the way that you'd imagined you would. And you may want to go back to prove yourself all over again.
Mm.
You know, so, yeah, and there is a commitment to the mission and to the task and to seeing it through. But more than anything, there's a commitment to your fellow soldiers and Marines. And that's what draws them back, I think.
We're discussing the civil-military divide with Christian Henderson, Richard Cohn, Sarah Sewell, and Neil James. This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and downloadable on your pod. Richard, your research found that both civilians and military personnel harbour a level of suspicion and mistrust about each other. You've talked about the cultural and historical background to this attitude, but it would seem to me, on the basis of my memory, that it was greatly intensified by the fiasco of Vietnam.
Yes, I think that's true. There's always an element of suspicion, but the polling data showed that I think the suspicion and lack of respect really bottomed out about 1980. But it then rose very quickly during the Reagan administration. The president made a very big point of praising military people and trying to restore a sense of self-respect and patriotism in the country. And it really worked. By 1987, the military was the most trusted or respected institution compared to other major institutions in society. And that has continued. So on the one level, you have, particularly between civilian elites and the highest military officers, some suspicions of each other. But generally across the population, there is, as Sarah says, a great deal of respect and gratitude at a distance of the military as an institution.
And I would have thought, Sarah, that the military, who are putting their lives on the line with constantly, must feel a bit miffed that most Americans are not really involved in the war. It's not just the 1% versus 99%, it's attitudinal.
Absolutely. I think miffed may be the wrong word.
I chose it very delicately, Sarah.
Well, I think they're confused. They don't understand how it is possible when their lives have been upended by their commitment and their service and the continual asking of more of them. They don't understand how it is that everyone else gets the instruction, as the president said, to go shopping.
Go shopping,
and,
yeah.
And that sense of, it's not betrayal, but that sense of being a lonely outpost of representing the society without having any semblance of sacrifice, even in the form of taxes, requested of the rest of the population, I think is very unhelpful and bewildering to those who serve. But that is a question of political leadership as much as it is the education of the public. And as Richard said earlier, the president can go a long way in helping to knit those segments of society together under the right circumstances. We haven't seen that form of leadership to date in the war on terror.
Neil James, one could observe that both Bush and our own Prime Minister are very good at transforming or mutating legitimate concerns about the war in Iraq with a lack of patriotism and the argument that you're undermining the servicemen. It makes it quite tricky for people who, in fact, respect their armed services but don't like the war.
Yeah, there's actually two parts to the debate, quite frankly, and you have to separate the patriotism out with the debate about, say, the commitment to Iraq itself. You're not necessarily unpatriotic if you logically criticise the commitment on objective grounds and sincere grounds. Patriotism's the last refuge of a scoundrel in some ways, and this is more a political wedge policy than one that the military would necessarily support, indeed.
And in fact, they'd recognise it for what it is, wouldn't they, Neil?
Well, they would, and I mean, it's quite controversial here in Australia, for example, that politicians of both sides of politics, but particularly from the government, seek high visibility at farewell and welcome back ceremonies for the troops. And we've criticised that for some years because
yes,
we think those ceremonies should be presided over by a neutral apolitical figure. By all means, invite the politicians, but they shouldn't be front and centre.
Perhaps Governor General rather than Prime Minister or opposition leader. Neil, our involvement in East Timor was one of our greatest successes, was it not, in terms of civilian military attitudes?
Well, it was, and a lot of that was because the Australian people had been following the Timor problem for a very long time. The East Timorese had a lot of political support, and it was across the political spectrum here in Australia. And also it was close. And it didn't seem as distant as a lot of our other commitments are. And also, to a large extent, particularly in the early days and for most of the commitment, Australia was the largest contingent and led it, and we were largely responsible for it internationally and diplomatically and strategically. And it was really the first time that that had happened in a big way in a theatre of operations for Australia since World War II. So the nation as a whole got caught up in it.
Neil, as you know, I'm a critic of the Coalition of the Willing in terms of Iraq, but I thought the Coalition of the Willing in the Solomon Islands was impressive. We took the program there for weeks, and I came out of it immensely impressed with what Australia was doing there. And so there are times when you can, in fact, win a degree of success or achievement creates bridges between the civilian, even the civilian sceptics in the military.
Well, particularly in operations in the Solomons, where it's very much a whole of government effort here in Australia, and the military are really just there providing a bit of security backup, a lot of logistics. But, you know, it's our financial advisors and our health advisors and our electoral advisors that are bearing a lot of the brunt of the effort. And that can only be to the good, because a lot of our overseas deployments at the moment, even to a fair extent in Iraq and Afghanistan, a whole of government efforts. I mean, the military are only there to hold the ring enough for there to be a political solution. But the actual solution requires an effort from the whole nation. And that's one of the problems that's starting to occur in Iraq, because the whole nation in the United States and in Australia is no longer behind the commitment.
Sarah, I want to get on to your humanitarian approach to counterinsurgency in a moment. It's a fascinating and I think crucially important area. But first, is Iraq a sort of a prime example of the problems which arise when there's little civil and military cooperation?
Yes, and Neil's exactly right when he talks about the importance of that in the context of an operation, whether you're calling it counterinsurgency or nation building or peacekeeping. You have to recognize that the military And the role of force is one of supporting civilian efforts, which really have to take the lead in order for success to be gained. And we have not been able to achieve that in Iraq for a variety of reasons.
Which we'll examine in a minute, because I find your arguments on this absolutely persuasive. Richard, back in 1994, you warned of the dangerous rift between the armed forces and the society they're meant to defend, citing the very worst breach of civilian control just after Clinton's election on the question of homosexuals serving openly in the armed forces, loss of civilian control of the military being the most dangerous scenario. Could you talk to that?
Well, I think it was a real problem in the 1990s, because the military was being reduced after the Cold War, and it had a visceral reaction personally to Bill Clinton. And he got off on a very bad start with the gays in the military controversy. I think it is mitigated to some degree by the reaction of the military to that experience, and by the kind of overbearing assertion of civilian control during Mr. Rumsfeld's administration. This tends to go a little bit in cycles, and there's now kind of building the feeling in the military and in some of the political thinking that the military has to stand up more to the civilians. So I think it's it goes back and forth. And when you have an administration that is, in a sense, as disingenuous as the Bush administration, and someone who's exercises leadership in such an abusive and in some ways deaf way as Donald Rumsfeld did.
Yes, the contrast is pretty powerful, isn't it? I just want to go back to this gay issue. Clinton's policy was a compromise after he tried lifting the long-standing ban on gays in the military. But since then, the service has lost almost 10,000 gays and lesbians under that don't ask, don't tell policy. Why?
Well, because it's going to be enforced. I think there's still among older members of the military, particularly in the officer corps, a hostility to gays. Part of it is religious-based. Part of it is just the traditional conservatism of the military. And so they're going to enforce the policy in some ways because they feel they have to. But it has been tragic. You know, some of these people who've been driven out have been linguists and very, very effective members. And We know perfectly well from other military establishments that homosexuals can serve very honorably and without disrupting the service. So I think there's going to be pressure, particularly if a Democratic administration comes in 2009 to lift that policy. But it'll also depend on the Congress, and it's still a very emotional thing.
Neil James, gays in the military in Australia, a problem?
Look, it's not a problem here. We went through this one about 15 years ago. We have no restrictions on homosexuals and lesbians serving in the military. I mean, we've had an SAS squadron commander who came out, the CEOs of frigates. It's not a problem here in a big way at all.
Mm. Now, Sarah, this is the part I've been looking forward to, because you're a considerable admirer of David Petraeus, and for good reason that you've worked with him. Let's put this into context. During your 5 years at the Pentagon, it was your job to try and get the military to change and broaden its focus. And General Petraeus, you regard as one of a handful of far-sighted military officers who understood the importance of nation building. Tell us about him and what you did together.
Well, General Petraeus is really unique, and I think history will look back and say, boy, this is an example of the right person at the right time, because he'd written his PhD at Princeton about Vietnam and about the need to look beyond the conventional overwhelming force Powell Doctrine approach to conflict and recognize that not only was more subtlety required and more integrated political military effort, but that you wouldn't necessarily have your entire country at war. And so he was very farsighted, and then he had the experience in Bosnia and the experience in Iraq twice of trying to work in an unconventional setting. So he was really already convinced in his intellect, in his mind, and then experienced on the ground the demands for the use of military force in an entirely different context than that in which he had been raised within the Army and the U.S. military. So when he came back and moved to Fort Leavenworth, where he was in charge of the doctrine and training for the Army, he was extremely open to rethinking this entire question and able to move the process in a way that probably no other individual could have.
You were an odd couple, Sarah, weren't you? You and David Petraeus. But the Army and the Marine Corps incorporated the banner of human rights into that new counterinsurgency manual.
Yes, they did. And I to say we were an odd couple is both true and false, because I knew Dave from when he was serving in Bosnia and when I was in the Defense Department. And so there's some sort of trajectory that we traveled together in terms of, and both of us had written theses on Vietnam. So, you know, we had this sense of counterinsurgency as being important and the failings that the country had made. We had the experience of peacekeeping in the 1990s in a low-threatened environment and saw how poorly equipped we were as a country and a military and a non-military arm of the U.S. government to carry these out. And then we saw in full relief the costs of that failing.
Sure.
In Iraq.
Now, clearly counterinsurgency is largely a political affair, yet it demands civilian leadership and action to work. And you point out that for all the counterinsurgency demands it's created, the Bush administration appears uninterested in fighting to fund and staff them. And I guess civilians must be very wary of getting involved in more Iraqs or more Iraqs. So what's the solution to this understandable reluctance?
Well, I argue that the big question is one of strategy and the U.S. role in the world, and that until we have some degree of national consensus about whether or not we're going to accept what I see as the Bush paradigm, which is we will revolutionize the world. We will conduct regime change in order to foment idealistic political experiments and create democratic beachheads in inhospitable regions of the world. That's one paradigm. And another paradigm, and the one with which I'm more comfortable and the one that I believe the counterinsurgency doctrine supports, is one in which you recognize that the global order as we've known it, the state system, the international system, is under siege by state failure and by international networks, whether they're terrorist or drug criminal. and that we need to stabilize them. So it's a revolutionary frame versus a stabilization frame. And until we have consensus on that point, counterinsurgency will be viewed suspiciously by those who say, I don't want to be part of just, you know, taking out foreign governments. I want to be part of building peace.
Sarah, surely a bipartisan commission on what you're talking about, on the strategies needed if it's to be adopted at a national policy level.
Indeed, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think ultimately this is a question of the United States' vision of itself and its role in the world and its understanding of global security. And we've got a huge division right now on that question. And as a result, we are, I think, remaining in denial about our responsibilities in the globe and the capabilities that we need to carry them out. And we're leaving the military hammer. You know, we're using that, the hammer that we have to try to solve problems for which it's very ill-suited. And the military, in turn, is being overstretched and feeling very much alone in this. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't think it's effective, and I don't think it's healthy for civil-military relations more broadly.
Christian Henderson, we're covering a lot of territory. You know, we're rushing all over the place, really. I'm wondering to what extent the military families that you know, that you've lived with, talk to, debate these sort of issues amongst themselves.
Not as much as we probably should, but, you know, we're just scrambling to keep up because of the challenges of, you know, being part of an overstretched military. You know, one of the things that I learned in talking with Sarah was that there are two pieces to this puzzle, and one is our overstretched military being asked to do things it's not meant to do, and the other piece is the way in which the State Department, which would be the civilian partner to the military in these kinds of operations, has been allowed to wither over the last 30 years.
Mm. Okay. Have you got any comment to make on this issue at the moment, Richard?
Well, I think it's a trend that's really goes back to World War II. There's been a kind of a militarization of American society, largely the product of the Cold War, but it really began in the Depression. And the military, as a kind of a non-controversial part of the society in terms of respect after Vietnam, simply assumed more roles and filled vacuums. And the State Department has been the subject of a lot of political attack, beginning really in the 1940s with the McCarthyite attacks and the Republican attacks on Dean Acheson and so on. And it was not properly funded. And I must say, I don't think it's had really very strong leadership in the last 15 years. We've had some terrific diplomats, but they haven't really built the institution of the State Department, and it's been displaced by the system of regional commanders and large staffs in the Defense Department. Its funding, its power, its influence, and the view of the United States as a kind of a guarantor of world security within the United States has allowed that funding and that power to accumulate.
Sarah, we've talked about, or perhaps now let us talk about it now, the Petraeus counterinsurgency strategy, the surge, is occurring, but it's a military surge. There doesn't seem to be a civilian surge involved to any extent. Does that not undermine any hopes he has of making this work?
I think it certainly makes it much more difficult. People tend to equate the surge in General Petraeus is taking command in Iraq with the implementation of the doctrine, but if we were implementing the doctrine that he oversaw, we'd have 300,000 troops in Iraq. We'd have a fulsome non-military effort, whereas we have virtually none, and now we learn diplomats can't even leave the green zone. And we would have a fundamentally different focus on the political progress among Iraqis, recognizing that ultimately that was the key to success. So I think that he's handicapped, if you will.
But he's fully aware of the fact that at some point the uniforms have got to be de-emphasized and replaced by the suits.
Oh, absolutely, and this is a central tenet of his, and it's where I think he is uniquely qualified for this job. He has made it clear all along that success in Iraq will be determined by Iraqis. He's been very plaintive in in seeking additional resources and programs and staffing from non-military components, there are just real questions about whether it's possible for anybody in uniform to deliver on either of those problems.
Sarah, does your heart go out to him watching him, you know, being forced into these into performance pieces, really, in front of these inquiries?
I think General Petraeus is very loyal to his service, to the military, to the country, and I think he is trying within the constraints that he probably recognizes better than anyone to do the best job that can be done. Having said that, I think it is a very steep challenge for even the most capable of men, which he is.
Neil, have we got a sort of a textbook like the one that Sarah and Petraeus worked on that's operative in the Australian military?
Yes, we have. And in fact, we've had one for a lot longer, basically because the Australian military has been doing counterinsurgency for well over half a century, you know, basically from the early 1950s onwards in Malaya and in Vietnam and other places.
Does it factor in human rights as a component?
Yes, it does, and it always has, basically based on a number of things, but mainly because Australian operational culture is very heavily based on the British way of war. And the only three counterinsurgency wars that have been won by the West in the last half century, Oman, Malaya and Northern Ireland, were all done basically using, you know, those type of theories. But the problem Australia has, of course, in operations in Iraq and Afghanistan is we're just a junior partner in a grand coalition. And it's very hard to be influential, although you could argue the Australians are disproportionately influential in some of the theorising and some of the planning. And every military is pretty much a reflection of the society it comes from. And it's easier to train Australian troops in counterinsurgency because their cross-cultural awareness skills are better because they travel overseas and know the world better than, say, with the average American digger, who often it's their first trip overseas when they're sent to somewhere like Iraq.
You're listening to LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, etc., and I'm speaking to military historian Richard Cohn, Sarah Sewell, who assisted in drafting the Petraeus counterinsurgency doctrine, Christian Henderson, who's a journalist and military spouse, and Neil James from the Australia Defence Association. Richard, a couple of years ago, I talked to Robert McNamara, who was expressing a great amount of sorrow and regret for his role in Vietnam, but I recall him as being being at least as assertive in his time as Donald Rumsfeld in 2003. How does the military cope with these civilians who were not only all powerful, it would seem, but far too powerful?
With great difficulty is the answer, Philip. I think they're brought up to at least acknowledge civilian control and to believe in it and accept it, but not very well trained or very well experienced on how to deal with it, I think, in a professional and effective manner. The reaction to McNamara was one of real hatred and disgust. His name still brings contempt.
Is that right, after all this time?
Oh, yes. And it brings contempt to the lips of officers who are two generations removed from any contact with it.
And will Rumsfeld stink in the military nostrils for as long, do you think?
Yes, I think he will. And interestingly enough, Rumsfeld has had much less impact on the military as an institution, on the Defense Department.
You're kidding. I was under the impression he'd completely sort of transmogrified it.
Well, that's what he would like to say, you know. I mean, but it's been a great deal of bluster. And if you go on the website as he was leaving office and looked at his list of accomplishments, it was really pretty lame. The transformation that he so boldly asserted was really a speed up of evolution in the department.
He wasn't kicking military, but the military were already realizing that these changes had to happen.
No question about that, and it was more rhetoric than reality. I mean, he didn't really fire anyone. He kneecapped some people, but it was.
You
really,
mean that he was just a cynical politician?
Well, I there's something to that. You know, Henry Kissinger called him one of the most effective bureaucratic warriors that the government had ever seen, and from Kissinger's lips, that's either high praise or great denigration, if you want to put it. But I think he'll go down as both an overrated and a rather unsuccessful Secretary of Defense.
Kristen, I remember vaguely the fact that the FDR's children all joined the military. You quote Robert Schaefer about the absence of the upper class and their kids from military service, and that military service is seen as a career choice for the underprivileged. I know that we've heard Richard sort of try to get our minds right on this, but is Schaefer right in your view?
There's a sense or perception that the military is recruiting from the underclass, you know, the really disadvantaged members of our culture. And studies indicate that they really are not. What they're aiming for is the middle. The severely disadvantaged don't have the skills and abilities to handle the jobs that a highly technical military requires now. And the more privileged members of our society just aren't interested.
Mm. Neil, I would have thought there are very few Australian parliamentarians with any combat or military experience, going back to the point that Richard made of the US.
Well, there's only one, in fact, Graham Edwards, and he retires at this election.
Only one. How extraordinary.
With combat experience. Tim Fisher was the second last.
This will be the first time since, 1916 that the parliament has no vets?
Well, in the coming election, there are two military officers standing for Labor who are both recent combat veterans. If they don't get up, we'll have the first parliament since 1916 without a veteran in it. And that actually does scare some of the more far-thinking people in the Defence Force.
So you need a few people who actually know what it's about as an influence in our parliamentary debates.
It's always a bit more comfortable when the people making the decisions have actually had to endure some of the experiences they're committing people to. It's a bit different in the Australian situation to the American one. In that the Minister for Defence in Australia is a member of the Parliament and a member of the governing party. So you don't quite get the abrasive constitutional problem you have in the United States, where the Secretary of Defence is a political appointee of the administration. But there's only 12 people in the entire Australian Parliament with any military experience whatsoever, and only one combat veteran. And that's historically quite a low figure.
Do you think we should conscript some, Neil?
It's not a case of that. I think, as we've seen from Labor's nominations in this election, there's a little bit of a natural trend going this way anyway. I think we've just been in a bit of a trough over the last decade or so, and things will start to pick up. Because if you look back at the parliaments of the 1970s and 80s, there was a smattering of veterans of the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And basically, they all retired before the new crop of veterans started to get pre-selected.
Neil, you're making the point that we're pretty experienced in counterinsurgency, and there's been a lot of peacekeeping missions in recent years. Are we overextended militarily in Iraq and Afghanistan?
No, we're not, but we're not that far off it to some extent. Where we've been lucky over the last few years is that most of our overseas commitments, and we've got four big ones running simultaneously at the moment, is that to a fair extent, we got away with it for a long time because they used different parts of the force structure. The problem now is that the on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground elements in Iraq and Afghanistan are pretty similar. Our special forces are certainly very stretched, and our problem is probably greater in Afghanistan than it is in Iraq, because it's a NATO-led operation and a large number of NATO countries aren't pulling their weight. We're not in NATO and we are.
Mm.
And if the Dutch, for example, choose not to renew their commitment, there'll be a serious problem where we are, because we're a junior partner to the Dutch and the Dutch are a junior partner in the wider coalition. So we could very quickly become reasonably extended, but it gets back to the old rule of three. If you've got a force structure, you need to maintain capabilities in threes, because at any one time, one lot's doing it, one lot's getting ready to do it next, and one lot's resting and recuperating after having just done it.
Hmm.
And our problem, quite simply, is we've maintained too many defence capabilities for years in ones and twos, and that's why we're having to expand the force at the moment to try and solve that problem.
Kristen, I'm going to find this hard to put into words that aren't clumsy. The American public has endured the fact that now, over 3,000 of the service people have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. But they would not, it seemed to me, endure for one minute the stories that came out of that military hospital where the treatment of the wounded wasn't up to scratch, or rather the buildings were, you know, clearly poorly maintained and in decay. Does that not suggest that there's still a vast residual respect, affection, and perhaps deep guilt about these characters that they send off to fight the fights?
Yes, and I think Sarah had it right, that there is, you know, a sense of gratefulness that someone else is doing this for me. And, you know, and like you say, guilt when they don't receive the care that they need when they come back. And while it's true that the military is respected generally, that support is actually fairly shallow. And I think that comes out in the discussion when, for instance, I mean, I myself am Quaker, so I have a foot both in the pacifist world and in the military world as a military spouse. And I'll be talking with fellow pacifists, and they'll say, well, you know, why do these soldiers go if they don't believe in the war? Because some don't. And I think what happens is that you're already asking these military service members to put their life on the line for the rest of us. And then you're asking them to hold our elected leaders accountable on top of that. You know, so not only are you asking them to do one job, but your own job as well as a civilian.
Sarah, in the last minutes we've got left, I want to put this question to you, Kristen and Richard. Should the troops stay in Iraq, Sarah?
I think they need to start coming home. And I think we need to fundamentally change the dynamic on the ground there, because I think the trajectory is negative for us. And I think simply returning to the status quo ante surge, i.e. just going, letting the surge dissipate and staying at the steady state levels we had been at about 130, isn't going to fundamentally change the political dynamic in Iraq. And I think that's what we need to do. At the same time, I think managing the consequences of a fragmenting Iraq, which is what I see happening, is a really tricky challenge that has to be very delicately managed and in a regional context.
Very briefly, Richard.
I agree with that, and I think the planning and the strategizing has to go forward as to how we do that. We're simply suppressing the civil war, delaying it in that country, and the emphasis has to be put, as General Petraeus and Sarah know, and Sarah has said, on the development of a civic society and a viable government there, and that's the key to both success such as it could be and the extraction of the American forces.
And Kristen?
Well, I'm just grateful that you're having this discussion, because the thing that I've been struck by since this article came out is how widespread this is through Western culture. You know, this growing gap in understanding and experience between the military and civilian worlds. I've heard from folks in many different countries telling me, oh, this rings true for us as well.
We've got to wrap it, and I thank you very, very much for your contributions. Richard Cohen, Professor of History and Peace, War and Defence from the University of North Carolina. Sarah Sewell, Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Kristen Henderson, journalist and author of While They're at War. And Neil James, Executive Director of the Australia Defence Association. Sarah's article appeared in the Foreign Service Journal this month. Kristen's can be found at her website, www.kristenhenderson.com. On our next, we're going to be talking about Ian Paisley, who after 56 years is stepping down from the church he founded, the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster. Stay tuned to Radio National for the news. We'll see you later.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.